This is Robert Cappuccio. Welcome to the Self-Help Antidote, a weekly dose of reason, perspective, and insight, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore authentic strategies and insights around personal transformation. Our commitment to you is to bring you some of the world's leading experts in the domains of fitness, wellness, coaching, and behavior change, separating fact from fallacy. Dr. Tamsin Astor, welcome to the Self-Help Antidote.
Well, hello, Bobby. Nice to see you.
So you walk across quite a few different realms. That sounds very mysterious, but I mean it more in the prolific rather than the metaphysical sense. You have your PhD in cognitive neuroscience. You're a yoga practitioner and enthusiast. There's nothing worse than a practitioner that lacks enthusiasm. So well done there. You are an executive coach. You're a wellness coach. Wow, that's quite an interesting background, all intersecting, all complementary, but your real passion and focus across all of the domains that you live within is behavior change and habit formation.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think the big passion is the thing that brings it all together, right? And I think underlying that is this concept of, you know, how can we do this joyfully? Because there's so much pain and trauma in the world right now, right?
There's quite a bit. It seems like cognitive load is increasing. And because of that, people are shrinking back into, I think, rigid constructs of ideology, and that they're kind of not, we seem to be in a defensive posture. I'm observing that anyway. I don't know if you're observing that in the world.
Right. I think that's because people, you know, want to create evidence to support their belief, right? Which we all know is a you know, a regular occurrence. But I think it's about being in the in-group, right? We know that there's safety with being in the in-group. There is safety with being amongst a group of people who think and believe as you do, right?
So it is about safety across the board. So if you take a look at it generally, you could observe anxiety, which is probably a degree of fear. So safety is what we're witnessing a lot of people seeking. It's just coming out in strange behaviors sometimes, but it's safety seeking.
Yeah, I think so. And also meaning making, right? And, you know, like, why are these horrible things happening, right? What could possibly be causing this, you know? And if I can attribute it to another group who thinks or feels differently from me, or I attribute it to people who don't believe what I believe, right? Then suddenly I can feel safe, right?
Right. There's an enemy. There's this overarching enemy, and all the ills in the world are created by this enemy. Mm-hmm. And then there's a group of good people who are basically crusaders of goodness and right thinking in the world. Just so happens, coincidentally, imagine my luck, I happen to be part of that group. That is strange. Like, why are we so strange? I'm not talking about me and you. Why we're so strange?
I'm strange.
That's why I had you on the show.
Like, who the fuck wants to be normal? Like, most I always of my find guests that are funny. Strange.
The better ones anyway.
I'm like, who wants to be normal? Like, this concept of being normal. And I think that's something that I see particularly with my teenagers, right? It's that you're dancing with that energy of like, can I be part of the in-group, right? Can I be quote unquote normal? Or is it like, fuck that energy. I want to stride out and create my own path, right?
So when it comes to expressing yourself, your values, your creativity, seeking safety, all of the dynamics that we're observing in our society, we're observing in our social circles, out of all the things that you're qualified to do, why the focus on behavior change?
So
what's the nexus?
For me, it was really about my own personal journey, right? So I was struggling and I was in pain. I was in pain because one of my children was struggling with cancer and I had all these kind of symptoms that nobody could figure out. And one of the problems, I think, with a lot of American healthcare is that symptom suppression is the first approach. Mm-hmm. right? It's like, okay, you've got these symptoms. We're not entirely sure of the underlying cause, but let's suppress the symptoms. And that to me felt like an irritating approach, right? Because I was like, how do I know whether I'm doing the right or wrong thing for my mental and emotional well-being, right? If you can't figure out what's causing it. So that really was sort of a big sort of driver for me and you know, connected with my thesis research, which I don't think I realized at the time, but now like looking back, you know, I can see the journey. But for me, I looked at the relationship between intentional action and reaction, right? So free will, as it were, there's my big intention and reactivity. And looking at that relationship gave me insight into how we react to the external world rather than how we're driven from the internal world. And when I got all these symptoms and couldn't figure out the cause, it irritated the shit out of me that the approach was to suppress symptoms without understanding the root cause. So for me, my work really evolved out of trying to solve my own problems, not finding a way to do it effectively in the kind of current status quo, and finding trainings that would make sense to me and helped heal me, right?
So you arrived where you were, not just as a result of your training, which helped, but you were in a position where I'm imagining there was a lot of helplessness, a lot of pain, a lot of compassion. And out of that was frustration. And that frustration led you to think, okay, if we're going to deal with the root causes, identifying the root causes, our way forward have to be action-based and intentional.
Right, exactly. And, you know, if we don't understand what's driving our behavior, if we don't understand what's making us unhappy and unhealthy, and we can't do anything about it. And that was one of the things that led me to Ayurveda, was that, you know, I was getting all of these symptoms and all of the Western, you know, allopathic doctors couldn't figure it out. And I started reading all these Ayurvedic books because I'd been trained in yoga. And one of the things that was so fascinating to me initially was that healthy in the West is defined as absence of disease. Healthy in the East, or in the Ayurvedic practitioner, that it's similar to traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, it's the Indian science of medicine, is, are you seated in the self, right? Healthy means, are you seated in the self, which is a completely different way of thinking about what it means to be a healthy human, right? It's not only are my physical body systems working, the 11 systems in our bodies functioning coherently and together, but it's also, am I happy, right? Am I doing stuff that lights me up, right? Because you can be physically healthy, right, and not meet any of the criteria for, you know, anxiety, depression, any of the sort of mental health things, or meeting any of the criteria for, you know, coronary heart disease or diabetes or any of those other things, but you still don't feel well because you're not suited in the self, right? Because you're not in an energetic alignment, right?
This is how me and you connected. So we're in a learning and development program together, and I had mentioned something on a coaching call. And I think this is the intersection of not just our conversation, but of me and you, where you brought up something that's not mentioned. So when you look at societal constructs around what success means, I was just literally talking to someone about this earlier, where there's such confusion around what she wants. And when you ask this person what she wants, she starts listing what's expected of her in terms of success. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to answer that question. And you're talking about something right now that, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's rapture. That's joy. The word that comes up for
that.
Me.
Yeah.
And are you successful and well if you're not experienced? And I don't mean all the time. I mean, life is not a never-ending ecstasy trip. It was back in the 1990s at raves, to be fair. But in the 21st century, it's not really. But if you're not experiencing a degree of rapture with a fair amount of consistency, can you say that you're successful, and can you really say that you are well?
Right. And I think you're absolutely right, because I think part of this is the shoulds. And I talk about that in my book, Force of Habit, right? Is that we get should on by society, right? Your gender, your religion, your partner, your parents, your job, all of that shit. They all should on us, right? You should want this. You should like this. You should be happy with this. You should, right? And then we should on ourselves, because we internalize all of that bullshit too, right? Mm-hmm. And so a big part of that is stepping back and kind of passing out the, you know, I'm a white woman, I'm a mother, I'm 46, right? These are the real kind of, you know, criteria of who I am as a person, right? Then there's the ought self, right? I ought to be 20 pounds lighter. I ought not to have gray hair. I ought to use anti-aging cream so that you can't see my wrinkles, right? All of this ought, I ought to make this much money. I ought to be happy with the lot I have, right? I ought to feel honored when a man whistles at me across the street, all that shit, right? And then there's the ideal stuff.
I haven't had that happen like in months.
Are you missing out?
Yeah, like ever since I moved to San Diego, not one man whistled at me.
So then we have to lean into like what really turns us on, right? What lights us up? And part of that, like getting into that state of joy, rapture, is like releasing all of that external shit and figuring out what really turns me on, right? What really excites me? What are the impacts I want to have? What is the legacy I want to leave? Whose lives do I want to improve, right? Not just, you know, I've got this degree, I should do this job, I live in this place, I should follow these things, check, 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 right?
That leads me into something that you had said earlier. Actually, there's two conversations that are coming up in my mind because Dr. John DeMartini was on the show a while ago, and he said that you know what sets your life on fire. You know what your highest values are. A lot of times it's repressed and you ignore that voice when it whispers, but you know. And you're bringing up the point that there are so many influences internally and in our outer world that are shooting all over us. Mm-hmm. And with all of these elements shooting all over us, how much does, you talked about intention versus reaction. How much does free will come into play? I have dry eyes right now, so I'm not actually crying. I'm not actually deeply moved. I'm just like, I don't know where this is coming from. So anyway, yeah. So if you're listening, I got tears streaming down my face, and it has nothing to do with me having my emotions carry me away. That'll be later in the podcast. We're at least 15 minutes away from that.
How much does free will? I mean, that's a really interesting question, you know, and we can dig into all of the sort of big philosophical.
Well, define the difference between intentional and reactive, because some people, they might not discern the line.
Right. So intentional is something that comes from within, right? It's volitional. It's driven by your own will, your own desire. Reaction is something that is a reaction to an external stimulus. So you could, you know, the most sort of fundamental way of breaking it down is looking at is what's the stimulus, right? Is there a stimulus that comes in and goes and you react to it, right? So that's a reaction, right? And what I was looking at with my thesis research was, how are these two motor systems connected? Because, you know, when you do a PhD, you're trying to find a question or answer a question that nobody else has done before. And what was really interesting is, as I was doing my undergraduate research with my thesis, with the guy who ended up doing my thesis with, Dr. Patrick Haggard, is that we were looking at and realizing that nobody had figured out the relationship between the intentional motor system and the reactive motor system. I.e., if you are facilitating an action in the intentional pathway, and we can get later to like how you actually look at that. What is actually going on in terms of the reactive motor pathway? Do they interrelate in any interesting way? Does the facilitation of the intentional pathway mean that the reactive system can react more quickly? So what does that mean for this? What we're looking at is, when you are preparing to do something intentionally and an external stimulus comes in, does the reaction happen faster or more slowly? Right?
That is fascinating.
So that's what I was looking at, because I was interested in the fact that, you know, there's all of this really interesting neuropsychological data to suggest the relationship between these two systems, right?
And what would be the answer to that?
What would be the answer to?
So if you're acting intentionally and mm-hmm. that volitional action is interrupted by an environmental stimuli, mm-hmm. does that dampen or facilitate your intentional response?
So what I found is that there's a switch cost. What I found was, by tracking the intentional preparation, i.e. I was looking at their brain waves and their pupil dilation, which gives you a particular definition of whether they are preparing that intentional action. So that data gave me the kind of external objective data of, are you preparing an intentional action or not? And on various trials, I'd interrupt that. And what I found was that when you switch from intention to reaction, there is a switch cost, which means or implies that there are two separate motor pathways, right? So that intentional preparation does not facilitate a reaction.
So much for people who say, like, I'm a great multitasker.
Multitasking is bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Only like 2% of the population can actually multitask. What you're doing is you're jumping back and forth between the two.
So it's cognitive flexibility more than actual multitasking is what we're talking about.
Right. And actually, most people do things more slowly when they're multitasking, right? Because they're not focusing all of that attention. You know, there's research that suggests it takes about 23 minutes to get back to the level of connection in a task when you're interrupted. So if you're reacting to like an Apple Watch, like flick on your wrist, if you've got a, you know, you've met your steps, there's a text, there's an alert, there's a calendar update, and you're in the middle of trying to write something, it takes up to 23 minutes to get back into that same level of concentration.
Wow. So that's a big concern for me, because we've transcended the information age. We're in the information age. No, we were in the information age. We're more likely in the communication age. The late social economist Neil Postman said that we're in a technopoly where there's more information than there is application. So rigor and learning and development, it's always been important. I mean, if you take a look at anything we've done, you could say that no change is possible without it being preceded with a behavior change. If you want to make changes in your life, you have to make changes in your life, and that cliche. But all of that is predicated upon learning. So if you're doing something today that you weren't able to do 5 years ago, how'd you do that? Well, I learned how to do it, which takes focused concentration. Yet we live in a world where we're constantly interrupted. Mm-hmm. So we've created an environment for ourselves that makes immersive learning extremely difficult, two, socially unacceptable. Like, how many people feel like if they're sitting in their office pre-COVID, before we were working from home, and they're going through scientific journals, well, that's not actually working. I'm not typing on something. I'm not having a conference call. I'm not having a conversation. When do we do our learning when our environment is structured with disruption?
Right. And I think that's one of the most sort of crucial ways that we have to work on our habits right now, really, is to limit the amount of information coming in, one, right? So that we're not dealing with all of them. Because with the amount of information that comes in on a regular basis, it's gigabytes a day. I mean, it's insane the amount of information that we consume every day. Two is how we organize that information that comes in, right? So that we're not just taking in a whole load of stuff and it's being scattered everywhere, right? That we've got some kind of coherency. And then the third piece that I think is really, really crucial. And if you look back to the ancients, you know, they were able to do it more effectively, is to create space. Right. If you don't create space between learning and using that information, you're not going to use that information correctly. And, you know, Rich Litvin, you probably have followed him or heard of him. He's a coach and a, you know, a creator. He said recently, I was watching him, he was talking about how most information is not new. What we're looking at is how information is combined and repackaged and reflected and interpreted. And the problem with the way that most of us structure our lives is that we don't create the space for that. Right?
We when don't you say creating the space, what do you mean? Because I don't think you mean go back to back meetings, conference calls, and you know, grind, go back to the multitasking, which is not effective in the first place. What is that space that allows us to organize our information with efficacy?
So one of the best things to do is, as you said, is not to have back-to-back meetings, right? We need to have space where we're not consuming information, right? And we think, oh, I'm taking a break. But most of us, when we take a break, we pick up our cell phones and we see who has texted us, what latest reactions have had to a tweet or an Instagram post or a reel or whatever the fuck it is that we've done, right? So we're not actually creating space where we're not consuming information. So one of the best ways to do that is to do something like going for a walk. Walking is brilliant, right? Because there's the repetitive action. It doesn't require a lot of effort unless you are, you know, walking down a really busy street and navigating all of the people and the signs. You know,
type A speed walker.
Exactly. You know, or like navigating, you know, I haven't been back to New York for a couple of years since the pandemic, but like, you know, navigating like, you know, Fifth Avenue at, you know, the time of day when everybody's coming in and out of work and the shops, and it's just, and you're just like, right? Going for a walk where you have a little bit of mental space and freedom, right? Or doing something that is different from what your normal thing is, right? So Einstein used to talk about how when he would get stuck on a problem and he was sitting there and focusing, he couldn't do it. So what he would do is he would go and play the violin, right? And playing the violin gave him that sense of forward motion, like going for a walk, but allowed his brain to open up, allowed him to see connections, allowed the creativity to occur, right? And I think that's
because he was forming new neural networks and connections in his brain.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the exact opposite advice you're given.
Yeah.
Because I could not in my audience so much. I'm sure they're out there. But I could almost hear people in my head going, performance isn't about like taking a break. It's grind. If focusing isn't working, focus harder, focus longer, force it. It's almost like I remember when one of the most intelligent, well-studied and well-practiced people in the health and fitness domain. This guy's world famous. I'm not going to mention his name, but I've done a lot of interviews. He's a good friend of mine. And he was talking about rest. Like if you're going into the gym and you're not only not getting stronger, but you noticed you're getting slightly weaker, what you need is time off, which from a common sense perspective, not to mention a physiological perspective, is completely reasonable. Mm-hmm. It's so reasonable. It's almost like to avoid hydration, you might want to drink water. Okay. Not earth-shattering information there. And I remember the post, because it was a video for my company. How many people like, that is ridiculous. You don't know what you're talking about, old man. Results come from training hard in the gym. Actually, they don't. The stimuli come from what happens in the gym. It's when you're resting. And it's almost like they abandoned reason and science, and we went down this sociological dogma. It was almost a moralization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
I find that fascinating. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that to me, having grown up in Europe and moved to the US and spent most of my adult life in the US, the thing that is fascinating to me is this concept of rest, right? Whether it's the fact that this country is one of only two countries in the world that has no paid maternity leave, so it doesn't recognize the importance of a woman's body and need to heal, right? And bond with their baby after she's born, to the fact that the vacations, you know, 78% of Americans don't take their full vacation time, which is often only 10 days a year, right? Most Americans lean into and reach out to their job when they're on vacation, right? So it's this sort of this idea that pushing more and hustling more and like is what's going to make us successful. But then look at, on the other hand, the burnout. Like, it's nuts what we're doing to ourselves, right? By this push, right? The amount of disease, the mental health crisis, all of these things are from pushing and not allowing the body to rest, not allowing the mind to rest.
I'm going to make an outrageous claim, and it's based on my limited, biased mind making an observation. It's kind of inflammatory. When you have conversations with people who are really successful. And I don't mean they have more stuff than their neighbor. I'm talking about what it is that they want to do is what they get to do every day. They almost listen to conversations like this and like, yeah, fair enough. Absolutely. It's like, why even bring it up? Where I really hear the grind, no hustle from, aside from people trying to sell you stuff on social media, is people that when you get to know them, they're struggling to pay their bills at the end of the month. They're suffering. So they're talking about an archetype that they don't belong to, how much of that do you reckon is someone's coping mechanism for social anxiety and uncertainty? How much of that dogma is actually fear talking, where if I just think like these people and do this and live this, I'm going to make it. I'm going to make it. It's tough now, but I don't know how, but I'm going to white knuckle my way to where I want to be, even though that's an undetermined destination.
Well, I think partly there is some truth that, you know, some people have got to where they are by working really hard. Right. And so there
everybody
are
everybody who's achieved anything.
And so there's a lot of narratives out in the public domain of like, you know, and the people who sort of do the myth busting of like the overnight success. No, it was 10 years before I got to this place. Right. So there is some, there is some truth in getting to where you want to be requires hard work. But I think the interesting piece is, what is the hard work? That's the piece that I find the most fascinating, right? So is the hard work of, you know, putting your phone on airplane, being really clear about what your values and vision and mission are, and saying no to a lot more stuff, having rock hard boundaries around where you're willing to spend your time, your effort, your money, your energy, right? Which on some level is a very different kind of work from busy work, right? And often busy work I see in my clients is and in my friends is that the busy work is filling the time and feeling productive by doing stuff rather than being comfortable and knowing who you are, right? Because when you get still, and I think that ties back into this rest concept, right? When you get still and quiet, you have to face what's going on. Right. And, you know, this concept first came to me really interestingly when I first started studying Buddhism. Right. I took refuge as a Buddhist in 2013, but I'd been studying Buddhism by that point for about 6 years. And I remember one of my first meditation teachers teaching me the most basic calm abiding shamatha meditation and saying, the other way you can think about this meditation is making friends with yourself. And I was like, ooh, right? Like, am I comfortable knowing where my mind goes when I'm still? Mm-hmm. Does it go to the future? Does it go to the past? Does it relive those awkward conversations? Does it relive the things I did or didn't do? Is it always thinking I'm going to be happy when, right? And I think that's also a big driver of the busy work, because if you stop, you have to face yourself, right?
And that is my whole point. It's not an indictment on hard work, but people just simply don't grind blindly to some destination and then they arrive. There is intentionality there. There's alignment with values there. Mm. There's also, heaven forbid, I had a business partner a long time ago, and in our company, we would work really hard, but I made the mistake one day of mentioning how much I enjoyed it, which made him really nervous. Like, wait, if we're enjoying it, we're not doing it right. Mm. You really think that hating what we do makes us more effective than loving it and experiencing rapture?
Right.
We have less creativity. We have less collaboration, less innovation. Do you think we're going to work harder at something we hate? It's interesting because you have this frenetic pursuit of the non-distinct. I think one question I have is, when you get into behavior change, obviously understanding what you're trying to do directs and informs your actions. Mm-hmm. In what ways do behavior change strategies give you a modicum of certainty that calms your level of anxiety down? Is there a correlation there?
That's an interesting question. I think the way that I do it is I break it down with my clients you have the psycho-cybernetic mechanism, right? That what you believe, you think, creates thoughts. What you think creates feelings. Your feelings create actions, and your actions create results, and your results feed your belief, right? So we're in this psycho-cybernetic mechanism. We're in this loop every day, right? And so one of the things that I will do with my clients who are stuck in that kind of cycle of trying to figure out, like, why am I doing something that is not making me happy? Or why am I not able to do the thing that I think will make my life better, right? Like, why can't I do this fucking habit that I think is going to make my life better? But for some reason it breaks down, is that we look at those different stages, right? And try to figure out, is it the belief that we need to change? Is it the feelings that we need to change? What's going on with the thoughts? And we look through that system, because some people will find it much easier to get in there with a particular angle. So they'll get in there and go, I don't think I'm worthy, right? So that's a belief, right? And then we'll go through that cycle. And once you start to understand the relationship between those stages, it can really help in terms of anxiety, because you can start to see, oh, I'm going into this space. Now, what could I do as a pattern interrupt, right? So I was talking about this with a client yesterday, and they decided that there was going to be a particular song they have that they love that's on a playlist, and that when they start going into that loop, they're going to play that song as a, like, oh, no, I'm not going to go into that loop again. I'm not going to waste time spinning in that negative cycle, right? And I'm not going to follow through with the behavior, which for them in this situation was overeating and overdrinking, right? Because of what was going on up here, right? And the thoughts and the feelings that this was creating, right? So I think when you can understand the relationship, it makes it much easier. And I think part of the problem is, as a society, you know, we've not done a good enough job of educating people around their emotions. You know, most people cannot label more than 7 emotions. Mm-hmm. So most people can't even recognize more than 3 on somebody else's face. And if you can't recognize what you feel, and then think about, why am I feeling this way? What's causing this? And then how am I then behaving, either to numb out that pain or because it's a habit that I've fallen into? I mean, I think the way that I find it useful to sometimes think about this is that the brain is going to create habits regardless of what's going on, right? The brain is agnostic. It doesn't give a fuck. It's just going to create systems, right? Because it's about being efficient, right? The more habits you have, the less energy your brain uses, right? We make 35,000 decisions every day. If your brain can automate some of those decisions, automate some of those behaviors, automate some of those habits, it reduces the moment-to-moment decision we make. The question is whether you can get in there and be in as intentional as fuck and create habit cycles, those loops that work for you and connect to your big juicy vision and connect to your value system, connect to the world that you are trying to create and be a part of.
So much of who you're talking about lands with me. I've had these conversations with a friend of mine, Nick Jarvis. He's a consultant out of the UK. I think you would get on really well because you kind of play in the same space. He was a consultant for the banking industry and then the health and fitness industry. And when you talk about that cycle, everything affects everything else. That's the first thing that comes to mind. People are like, well, is it about taking action or is it about belief or is it about your attitude? It's everything. And it's impossible to pull a single lever and not have every other lever change position in response. But there's also more to that where we're so conditioned. I don't think intentionally, but just environmentally, to be having an out-of-body experience. Mm-hmm. You don't have to wait until you're near death to have an out-of-body experience. You're likely having one most of the time. You get into a lift or an elevator and someone's like, oh, how you feeling? Fine. Okay. That's not a feeling. That's not an emotional state. Or busy. That's a prediction around a status appraisal. That is not an emotion. So it's really hard to get in touch with how are my emotions driving how I feel, right? Feelings being an awareness of an emotion. How's that driving thoughts and perceptions? How's that driving behaviors? And how is that affecting outcomes?
Right. And I think that, and learning to integrate, I think is one of the most important things we can do, right? In the yogic Ayurvedic model of the human, we have what are called koshas, which are layers, like a Russian stacking doll, right? Or the layers of an onion. And, you know, most of us focus on the anamaya kosha, right? The physical body. We focus on how it looks, how it functions, what's going on. Then we've got the mental body, the manomaya kosha, which a lot of the time leaves our body, right? Like we're reading it fast. fascinating book, right? And our mind has like gone off to Korea or to Japan or to, you know, living this different, completely different life, right? Your mind is
93% of the day, literally.
Right. Right. Then we have the breath or energy body, the pranamaya kosha. And then we have the intuitive body. So we've got all these layers, right? And when we're healthy and well, they are in alignment, right? When we are fully present, we are in alignment. And one of the things that's always interesting to me when I talk to people about that is, and they start to do that whole, like, that sounds like a whole load of fucking bullshit, you know, and you're, and like, that sounds woo, and all of those kind of derogatory ways of thinking about energy, because a lot of people have, you know, don't believe in the validity of it because there isn't the, like, the quote unquote hard science. And I'll say to somebody, when you walk into a room, can you feel whether somebody's sad? Can you feel that they're angry? Can you feel their joy? Yeah. I'm like, that's their energy body extending out into the world, right? And you can start playing with that and feeling that and getting connected to that. And then also working on like other people's negative energy coming in. And we start to play with all of those pieces. But I think for so many of us, we live in a disintegrated way for most of our lives and most of our days. And when you are in that disintegrated and lack of alignment, you can't listen to how you feel. You're not in your body, right? You don't feel like my feet are on the ground. I'm in this space. And that's when we also end up with, I think, a lot of situations of massive kind of boundary violations around how we let people treat us, right? Because we're not fully aligned and going, that doesn't feel good, right? Like, I love Brené Brown's definition of a boundary, right? Like, what feels good? Right? Which allows for the flexibility. But then we also have, you know, so much disease. Like, I fell in prey to that. You know, I herniated a disc because I have a high pain threshold and was in a state of exhaustion and overwhelm and serving everybody else, not myself. Right. And I'd stopped listening to my body. Right. And boom, I got to this point of extreme, you know, pain, and, you know, chronic issues that I've had to learn to deal with because I was not energetically aligned, because I didn't slow down and listen to myself and notice when those pieces of myself were not there.
I wonder sometimes if this reductionist fragmentization of life is by design or by default. For a lot of us, it's by default, but how does a system that depends on perpetuating dissatisfaction for its affluence talk about integration? I know that's a really big question, because I need to convince you of two things. One, there is a you that is completely separate from me and from the whole. And there's this thing called happiness out there. And by the way, you don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
You as a separate entity don't have this thing that you know you should want, because we're taught happiness is so important. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the United States, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of, you'd think that if a nation was chasing something for a couple of centuries, we would have gotten closer to catching up with it by now. I mean, this thing moves very, very quickly. It's very elusive. And my own personal take on this is, the more you chase something, the more it runs. I mean, dating in high school should have taught you this. You know, you attract things, you don't chase them. You know, go do something meaningful. Happiness will start to show up. Right. Unexpectedly. But I've got to convince you that you don't have it. You need it. It's what you want most. But if you only had this, you'd be happier. If you just had better skin, if you had a better car, not you, because your car is amazing. I don't even want to talk to you about your car. But if you had more of these things, but you would have it. But if you stopped for a second and said, well, if you were more integrated with yourself and how that self relates to others, that stuff doesn't have as much of a hold on you. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying that when you hop into your MG, you don't feel amazing. You probably do. And I hate you, by the way, but it wouldn't have as much of a hold. It's nice to have, but not a necessity.
Right. And I think that, you know, happiness is, as you say, like something that you grasp at, you know, I mean, that's interesting. Like if you look at, what's his name? Tennyson. He's written this fascinating book called The Conscious Language, The Logos of Now. And he talks a lot about the power of the words that we use and how that creates that, right? So for example, using the word want, right? That implies a lack, right? A want of something, right? Craving, you know, like all of this, like, rather than that, the softer energy around that. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you were talking, what I was thinking about was the countries that have the highest records or the highest ratings of what it means to be happy, which, you know, then people look to Scandinavia and say, how are these countries so much happier than us, right? Like, what are we doing wrong, right? And what can we learn from them? And, you know, it's like, oh, they pay much higher taxes. Oh, we don't want to pay higher taxes, right?
I don't think that's what's making them happy, but...
Right, but it is. It's like, we try to make sense of it, you know? And I think the piece that I feel like that's often missed from that is that these countries are much more homogenous, right? So, you know, people are often much more comfortable paying higher taxes, right? When everybody looks the same as them, when everybody believes in the same God as them, when everybody, you know, has the same skin and all of that kind of shit, right? So we sort of forget about that piece and how that contributes to the bigger story. But I think the concept of grasping is the piece that is most interesting here, right? Because I think there's a, you know, we don't want to move through the world without having something that's pulling us forward, right? Having a bigger mission, a vision, a thing that pulls you forward every day, something that lights you up is important, but not to the detriment of your daily functioning, right? So it's this sort of interesting tangent, I think, that we walk, this sort of energy of like, yes, this is where I'm going. This is what I'm trying to create. This is the place I'm moving to. These are the things that I'm, you know, leaning into. But if I'm not there right now, that I can't be happy, right?
See, and that's the difference. Like if you want to see hard work, look at kids at play. They're completely immersed. They will play for hours on end. Usually when play ends, it's because there's an imminent event like dinner or something interrupts them. Their parents come get them or they've completely exhausted themselves. What's the outcome that they're trying to produce through play? Because I also believe having an inspiring, deeply meaningful outcome out there that you're working to achieve is important. But there's a contrast at the same exact time. There's a paradox.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're working for something out there, but the pursuit of it and the work itself is intrinsically rewarding. Kids are not playing so that they get to win play for the day.
Right.
They're playing because the payoff is in the process itself. I get to play and that is the reward. And how many people don't show up to work like that? How many people? And that's why I think this grind mentality comes in, because if you're completely immersed, there is the discernible line between work and play does get a little bit more blurred. And how amazing is that?
Right. And it's that flow energy, right? And that's like Mihai Csikszentmihalyi's research, right? That came out about flow. Like what, when we're in a state of flow, what actually goes on? What is happening to us, right? We're in a state where we lose track of time. We forget the need to go to the bathroom, right? We are just completely engaged in the process around us. And, you know, that comes back to that conversation, the piece we were talking about earlier about, you know, dealing with all of the input, right? And what does hard work mean? So in some senses, you know, creating that space for play is hard work, right? Because everybody's like, well, what do you mean you're taking Friday afternoons off? What do you mean you're spending 2 weeks backpacking? What do you mean you're deleting your social media apps for a month? Like, that's not the way to be successful, right? So when you get into that state of flow and play, but softly holding that bigger vision, softly holding that bigger piece. And it's that dance, I think, that, you know, coming back to what you're saying, who are the most successful people in the world, right? They really know who they are. They know what they're doing. They've got a big, juicy fucking mission, right? They have a desire to impact the world in a particular play. And they have done the hard work of really focusing in on that and not consuming all this other information and just, right? And that brings joy. But I mean, I think The other thing that you're talking about that I find really interesting too, have you read Existential Kink by Dr. Carolyn Elliott?
No, I haven't.
Oh, you dig it. So she talks a lot about in that about the shadow, right? And how when we can identify the shadows in our lives and really lean into the energy of enjoying it.
Are you talking about in the Jungian sense?
Yes. Yeah. But she provides it interestingly with a lens, like what got her into writing this book was going in, like looking at the BDSM community and going, hang on, like most people being tied up and whipped, like that's painful. What, how do they get pleasure out of that? Right. And so the sort of concept of this book, which I think is really interesting, and back to that conversation of, are we trying to live in rapture and joy 100% of the time? No, like none of us can be in rapture and joy 100% of the time. But the question is, when we lean into that space where we're like, this feels painful, this feels difficult, this feels upsetting, and maybe we go down the numbing route rather than looking into that like intentional behavior cycle, right? That habit loop. If we go, ooh, why does this feel painful to me? Like, can I get interested in the discomfort, right? And so that's what she is, the sort of the thesis she's promoting in this book is that you lean into the discomfort, and rather than just going, blah, 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 next, right? You get in there.
And this is where the moralization gets in the way, because it's not leaning into discomfort as an exploration, as introspection. A lot of times people talk about leaning into discomfort as a moral imperative, and it's almost an indictment. Like I hear from people who I love and adore, oh, well, the reason why people are not happy and they're not quote unquote successful is they seek comfort. They're inherently lazy. It's like, those are all wild assumptions, and it's okay to have assumptions. I don't think you can get through life without an assumption. You know, I'm going to have lunch later today, and that's based on a series of assumptions, but it's being aware of those assumptions and weighing those assumptions to the context and the greater reality. And it's where leaning into something painful that Viktor Frankl says this, where he says despair, or said this, despair is suffering in the absence of meaning. And I was always asking, well, then what is suffering in the presence of meaning? That must be passion. And if I'm willing to sit with discomfort because there's a greater purpose to it, and because I understand the whole thing around negativity. Well, negativity is bad. Positivity is good. You know, that person's negative. What we're really saying is, well, she's bad, but she's good. Where if I lean into this, there's discovery around what are my basic human needs that are going unmet? Because if you go without pleasure for a while, okay, life might suck for you. If there's meaning behind that delayed gratification, that's a completely different story. But historically, imagine our species in the absence of pain. We wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation because we would have gone... There was a time when we came very close to being extinct, and what pulled us out of that was pain. Pain is a signal. Right. Okay, there's a need I have and it's not going met. And if I'm willing to sit in that and not judge that and go, oh my God, I'm being so negative right now. I need to be positive and put on like the positivity, which is irritating before I
we don't want party. That. Yes, that white knuckling of positivity, that toxic positivity, right?
That's a great way. Toxic positivity or weaponized positivity, if you will.
Yeah.
Sometimes sitting in the pain and the suck helps you arrive at insights that are critical, not only for your growth and development as an imperative, but your happiness.
Yeah. Totally, totally. And that's also where we cultivate resilience too, right? It's through navigating the pain. It's through pruning off the things that are not working, right? It's through cultivating and recognizing the growth, right? You know, even if it's like, well, that sucked, I don't want to do that again, you know, to how can I integrate on a much deeper level what I've gone through so that I can show up in a more honest and truthful and resonant way for the people that I love to serve, right?
So when you have honesty and you have resonance, you start to get clarity.
Yeah.
So I think a great way to wrap up, question I want to wrap up on is, let's assume I have clarity about where I am now versus where I want to be. And you can represent this image in your mind. like you're standing in one landmass and between where you want to be, there's a chasm. What would be your advice? If I know I can see that point in my mind's eye of where I want to be, but there's a chasm, there's a barrier, a gap in between it, what advice would you succinctly give around how to effectively start to build a bridge?
Oh, that's such a juicy, fun question. Okay. I think one of the first things I would say is you have to work on your mental habits, because the thing that I see the most is a derailing between like the daily actions, getting to that big, you know, the other side are the mental habits, right? Like if you are not committing every day to working on your mental strength, your mindset, you know, being aware that the five people you spend the most time with contribute to your average, you know, behavior and emotional regulation, right? You are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. Who are you spending time with every day, right? Mm-hmm. What are you consuming, right? Whether it's what food are you eating? What ideas are you taking in? What energies are you allowing into your space? So having a really clear idea that how I spend my time now is going to get me to that where I want to go. So the daily habits. And am I really, really clear on keeping my mental habits, my mental health, my mindset in alignment with where I want to go? Because if we don't cultivate the relationships around us and the inner strength, we will get derailed, right? We'll get pushed off by the shoulds. We'll get pushed off by the pain. We'll get pushed off by things that are completely outside of our control, like the pandemic, right? There's so much in life that we can't control. Look at what you can control. Look at how you spend your time. Look at who you're spending your time with. Look at how you are working with your mental habits.
I love your balance between intrinsic motivational drivers and external environmental influences. Usually people take a look at transformation in a silo. Well, it's all about motive or context is irrelevant. You create your own context. Probably not. Or on the other end, all behavior is driven by external environment. No.
The behaviorists. It's
everything is dependent upon everything else. And I love how you talk about affiliation. A lot of people popularly credit Jim Rohn. Mm-hmm. And Jim Rohn was an advocate of how affiliation supports and drives transformation. But we do have to look at groundbreaking researchers, people like Phil Zimbardo, Stanley mm-hmm. Milgram, right. Solomon yeah. Ash, Dr. David McClellan, and many, many other people that we don't, it's not coming to mind. We don't have time to list that have worked within this space and tested and measured. And yes, who right. you surround yourself. And that doesn't mean, if you've got like a friend who's not achieving what you want to achieve, you got to get rid of that person. That's not what we're saying. We're saying there's room to expand your groups. You can have different mm-hmm. categories, but mm-hmm. if you change your environment and people are a major mm-hmm. element of that environment, mm-hmm. it facilitates the evolution of you becoming the type of person you want to be so you can exactly. do the things you want to do.
Right. And so one of the sort of the easiest ways to do that is to find communities of people who do or have what it is that you are trying to create. Right. So like one of the mantras I often say to myself is, can I put myself in the room where I'm the least smart, the least skilled, the least intelligent? The
that's
least
easy capable? For me. It's almost right? by default. I don't have to try.
You're far too self-deprecating, Bobby.
Says the English woman. That's rich.
But no, I mean, that is one of the easiest ways to pull yourself forward, right? If you are always the top of the pile in any space you're operating in, you know, you're not going to get pulled forward, right? And not to say that being in a place of mentorship isn't incredibly important, right? Because we're trying to pull everybody else forward and support everybody else. But if we are always at the top of the pile, we're not going to get there as easily or as quickly as we want.
Yeah, exactly. Tonight, I'm doing a meetup just for that exact reason. I mean, to be fair, it's a bunch of expats getting together, drinking and hurling insults at one another. I'm not exactly sure that that's what you mean, but yeah, close enough. Dr. Aster, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a fascinating conversation with lots of interesting, wicked tangents. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Visit us at theselfhelpantidote.com to share your feedback, insights, and recommendations on what topics you'd like us to explore in the future.